This is Safety Query number 5703C29AKC, Electric Elron Hubbardson the 17th Advanced Clinical Course, entitled The Professional Scientologist, copyright by Elron Hubbard, 1957, World Rights Reserved.
Lecture number 24, the 17th ACC, 29th, 1957. And this lecture, of course, traditionally should simply be a wind-up lecture. However, I am afraid that there is material which you should have, odds and ends of material, which have to do with the profession of a professional Scientologist. Very little has been said on this subject, and it should be understood that something can be said. And so the title of this lecture is The Professional Scientologist. People read books, they hear about it, they read books, they get training one way or the other, and they carry through at one level or another of training. They might even work haphazardly or regularly at processing people, being Scientologists on an auditing basis. And there have grown up a considerable core of these people, not just in the United States, but throughout the world. Today, saving grace on at least one European nation is Scientology. If Ireland ever picks its head up out of the sod, it will be because of Scientology. It will be because of professional Scientology. The United States today is fast approaching a saturation point of being on one level or another, and it may come about one of these days that man obtains something more than fascism because we were doing some small part of holding those ramparts against the encroachment of fascism and slavery. We already have been responsible for throwing one very large organization in this country into a complete change of policy and a complete change of procedure, its public attitude, and we have brought it under a hammer and pound of criticism, an organization which was slaughtering patients by the ton. We didn't mention their names. They've blocked the legislation at every turn, and they've gotten to a point of apathy now where they don't even like that. The least they can say to some patients, they can say, should I take Scientology processing? They say, well, actually, the truth of the matter is that every Scientologist has a psychiatrist to treat him, and Hubbard is insane. It's the least they can do, and this is not much of a program. It's not much of a program. That's what they've been reduced to. They've been reduced to an appropriation which approximated $500,000 to flatten. And it's the Scientology down to the point where they just sit back in their offices and mutter. And the field is open today to the professional Scientologist. Any level of Scientology he wishes to conduct is free and open to him. We owe the freedom of operation in the field of simply practice, initially to Mary Baker Eddy and her efforts on behalf of spiritual healing and ministers, when the American Medical Association was trying to put pattern legislation into every legislature in the United States at the turn of the century. And Mary Baker Eddy and the Christian Science Church caused to be written into law an exemption for all persons practicing in the field of spiritual healing. In almost all states, except those states where Mary Baker Eddy and her people did not put up a fight, have legislation which includes within it now the right to practice and the right to heal by spiritual means. We come under that category. Biomedics was a mental science. Still is. The therapy, the lids. Scientology is not. It's a much broader look at life, and more importantly, it is a considerable addition to man's knowledge in science. It is his first, you might say, spiritual look at science in general. paid so that man can survive the strictures of society regulated by and working alongside of a machine. Now, we have had our way to practice clergy by operating as a founding church of Scientology of Washington, D.C., and by keeping our ministerial relations in very good order. We have opened the doors of every institution in the world, if you want to try. Some of these institutions will say, well, no, we will not admit ministers, but all you have to do is go down and say to the city council, did you know that the general hospital won't admit ministers to their agents? Well, that's humorous, and so we need probably the head of the hospital. Not like that. Dang. It's something that city councils know they better not tamper with. The fact of the matter is that the world of religion had hit a very narrow point. No longer very effective, the world at large, but it left forms, it left channels, it left ways and means, it left doors open. And actual knowledge in the field of the spirit and the mind and human beingness, when it appeared, it could adapt itself to these already carved channels. You mustn't at any time confuse yourself with somebody who is yelling hellfire and damnation. That is not the definition of religion. You may have on your backtrack an unhappy career as priest or heretic or something of the sort, and I ask you to overcome this because religion is still a respected field, and it is up to you and you alone to make it a highly respected field. You have to fight back and walk all the way up the line from where old time religion left off. But the channels are there, the doors are open. The ways and means exist so that you can walk through the world and do almost anything you please with Scientology if you continue on in the field of Scientology or spiritual science. Quite important. I'm giving you some of the things you could do. You visit an insane asylum. And if you did not like the conditions there, you would complain. And you would complain loud enough to a governor, or a state board, so as to cause the whole administration of that insane asylum to be overturned and reformed along more definitely humanitarian lines. And that's not a little thing that you can do. Since in these institutions throughout the country, they kill several thousand patients a year. They sterilize several thousand more. Take perfectly good, usual, run-of-the-mill cases suffering from a little sadness or grief or apathy, and they confirm their psychosis. These reactogenic psychoses, reactogenic means caused by doctors, and it's a reactogenic psychosis that is more than anything else feeding this country. It is up to somebody such as ourselves to do something about that. If we start to do anything about it, I can assure you that we will sooner or later, inherit the entirety of institutional conduct and activity in America. It may be desirable, it may not be. You can go into the hospital and you can change the condition of healing in that hospital. Now that's a big look. That's doing a lot. That's taking a large amount of responsibility. But there are much smaller fields of action, perhaps even more infused realities, as you could say. You can walk into any of these places, have a little perseverance, and knowing to say the right thing at the right time. You'll undoubtedly get fish out of the pond of Never Never, almost any patient therein. As a minister, you have that right. Man realizes instinctively that the only healing there is comes from the spirit, therefore he has been very careful to leave that road open. Now, that is just in the field of healing. We extend that field of healing to the degree of establishing an office, of establishing a center, a rather larger office, and by various ways and means, most of them centered on the circulation and dissemination of books. Establish yourself a very nice sphere of influence in almost any city. That would be a sort of our personal practice or a clinical practice. We would do that this in an additional way. We would recruit people to a personal efficiency course and work in a few personal efficiency ways. We do them very nicely. And so long as you abided by the rules of the game as to how to handle groups, I can assure you that you would have a continually successful group. You must realize that groups in the past have ebbed and flowed in their membership because the persons running those groups were not well in control of those groups. They were running on a totally permissive, you do what you choose, sort of an attitude, and the group would come, and a group member would stay only on the average of about 8 weeks, and then he would go. Why? Because he'd gotten out of Scientology, when he had come into it, so he'd lost some fanatic, or he had buried his life in some fashion. He didn't understand there was anything more there. But if you give PE courses, and if you educate people, that there is more to be had from Scientology than some person and goal, which is rather small and anyhow, you could build yourself up rather larger groups that have been built. But running a PE course entails a great deal more personal presence and skill on your part than has been routinely demonstrated. It is quite a trick. You take one PE instructor, and you give him 50 people on a Monday night, and he's going on through the rest of the week, and by Friday night, having lost people Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, he does not have more than two or three people present. And what did he do? He just stood up and talked. He didn't bite his nails, square his teeth, or anything of the sort, but just didn't come back. And then we take another PE instructor, and we start with him Monday night with 50 people, and Friday night he has 46. He lost only two or three. People came there just for curiosity, didn't have any idea of staying at all, and they didn't stay. But several more in that group that didn't intend to stay did. What's the difference between these two instructors? What's the difference between these two PE group conductors? The administration could be a difference. Administration, what time does the class start, what time does the class break, the proper papers handed out to them in an orderly fashion, they get in their study texts and materials made available to them and so forth. That rather makes for a smooth course and it has something to do with it. But it is under the heading of handling human beings. Whether that course wins or loses is determined by the ability of the instructor to handle those people present. His ability to control groups, his ability to confront a group. Now, if all you can do to a group is lecture, I feel for them. You just talk to them. But that is quite an accomplishment. To be able to stand up with complete relaxation, talk to strange groups of people. That's something all by itself, isn't it? And yet that's not enough to run a successful PE course. If that's all you're going to do, you won't have a course by Friday night. The type of auditing and group defining which was used is by Dr. Barrett. Keeps the group coming. It takes personal presence to do that, but more important, it takes a complete fearlessness and complete self-confidence that one can continue to control the group no matter what they say. And a person who only lectures to the group does not have the group contributing. And he never gets the group up to contribute to. Never gets it up there. And so it never hangs together as a group. But here we have another factor. When those people in that group are given the right to speak, the one who can only lecture becomes a little bit afraid because it seems to him that the group is going out from under his control. If he lets this one talk and that one talk and another one talk and another one talk, he feels as though the group is departing from under his control. Then he has tendency to shut him up and nothing below contribute to.
That's why they never contribute to him.
They never contribute to the organization. And they simply go away. Quite interesting, isn't it? Fascinating. It's actually a difference on ability to control. The one who lost all of the students, who lost all of the people who enrolled, was, it will be found, unwilling to control a group which was itself talking back. That's what it amounts to. You've got to be able to let that group talk back and still knock them back into control again. You've got to be able to start changing and stop them. You've got to be able to turn around to this person and that in the group and tell them to talk and tell them to shut up. With good ARC. And we say to a large group like this, well, what do you suppose the definition is for the word create? How would you define this word create? What is create? Who's the first one that speaks up? Usually in a new strange group, it'll be somebody who is brash. He just speaks up on an automaticity. Usually some compulsive outflow prompts him. Well, are you going to let him talk for the rest of the week? How much can this man say? How much can we let him say? Will we let him say enough to offer a definition? And the second that he has offered anything that vaguely sounds like a definition, you shut him off with the rest of the group. How do you do that? You simply turn around to the rest of the group and ask, do you think that's right? And of course, they don't want to be identified either. You know, the big crime of the universe is communicate, and the other crimes to be there, and they're doing both. Well, you're asking them to communicate, and they're already there, and that's pretty brave. So, don't expect that they will answer up all at once or something like that. They won't. You have to point your finger at the little girl on the aisle, and you have to say, do you agree with that? Or would you say, speak up? Well, no, I don't think I did. Well, how would you define creating? The other fellow still may be talking. You yourself don't feel that you can put the clamps on the entirety of the group. You can always put the group under the control of the group. Very easy to do. I use both methods. I take the group, it's starting to talk, it's getting unruly, it's doing this, it's doing that. And I just make the rest of the group shut up both and do more talking. It's very easy to have a group. You keep talking to them, do you agree with that? Is that your idea of it? Just like Dr. Barrett. And you'll find out a group stays under control. And that method of teaching a PV course, or knocking into the heads of people who are brand new in the subject, is so superior to straight lecturing that it cannot be compared. It is just a unique apart. So what would you do if you went into an additional field now, not running a PE course, but you went around to the Greg Shorthand College, and you said, I run a business efficiency office, and I'm an expert on efficiency, learning rate, teaching people, that's right, I understand part of it. Well, it'd be pretty easy to learn. Too impressive to be overlooked. At once want to know what a complicated word like that means. You don't know what that means. Well, that's the science of knowing how to know. Well, that's the science of controlling people. Didn't you know that? Anything you wanted to point it as, but you give them some sort of a definition that tells them that there is something to know about this. And then you say, I would be very happy to volunteer my services if your students have a little time one night this week, and I would like to talk to them. And they say, well, kind of, what's in this for us? And you say, nothing. Is it an added service? Maybe someone will then come over and take one of my courses. Maybe some of the people who are taking my courses would like to come over and take some of their courses. And the head of the Greg College said, you say, yeah, what do you know? That's a good idea. Somebody will scratch my back by scratching, then go on and talk to them. You say, I'll put up your sign on my bulletin board. If you put up my sign, Hey, you're saying I'm mine?
Well,
holiday. This is very easy, by the way. It takes a little personality. It's very easy to take these commercial colleges and schools in general and talk to them at large. And what do you do? Stand up and say, blah, 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 blah. Turn the tables on them. Turn the tables on them. Say, hey, what's creation? And say, he's asking me, well, it's a hypothetical question, he's going to answer it himself. Moment. Well, you don't. And that surprises me. And this approach is so startling and so new that it all by itself becomes rather therapeutic. Quite interesting. You get a lot of this in your auditory and preacher conference, but you really don't know how much these do at large for a group. Some of you get as minor as that. People giving reports one after the other. There is such a thing as relaying information to people. But people at large don't have that many attention units to fire, and they very often don't listen. People have to be way upscale to hear what you say. And there is yet and there, as is demonstrated by the four or after curves drawn on groups on which this agreement method has been used, tell us that these people come up to a point where they can hear. You could lecture to them after that. After they'd had 2 or 3 weeks or so, then they'd finally listen to them. Quite amazing. But this method could be used on an army group. You don't care whether they're friendly or unfriendly. It doesn't matter. They'll be friendly very shortly. They don't want to know what you're getting at. And you get somebody to define that. Don't be driven into a defensive position. And don't go into an obsessive communication with the 2 or 3 of the group that obsessively communicate. Learn after a while that there are certain people in the group who won't communicate at all. There are certain people who communicate on an average. And there are certain people who communicate all the time. You'd only find yourself talking to the last group. Don't do that. Take the average wince and pull in the low one. Spot somebody sitting back in a corner, a little mousy looking man with four-rim tentacles. He's been sitting there and he had been saying, hey, all evening. Why would you say, you sir? Sitting back there in the corner. Yes, you. Now, what is your definition of being? And he said, Now, you've been sitting there a long time, and I know that you must have observed quite a bit. You've thought about this quite a bit. Give us the benefit of what you have established in your own mind. Well, you can get enough, and he's asking you to contribute. Well, it's done. Has to be pretty smooth, has to have a good high ARC. But there's always the group to stop the group. Even a bunch of juvenile delinquents shipped into the army just to get rid of them. Even a bunch of London tuts have been handled successfully on this basis. Teaching by definition has been handled with great success. London tuts, mind you, that were completely out of the control of a London club were brought in and made to defiance. They listened. And the board that ran that club that tried to keep these little tuts off the streets, mama's a prostitute, daddy's a burglar, this sort of social lover, were absolutely flabbergasted with the Scientology minister. They wanted to know what kind of stuff was it that made people like this, who could actually handle and control such a large group of ordinary, unruly, insulting young brats. He actually wasn't doing much control on the thing. He simply asked them to contribute, and they did. So I asked him to explain a few things, and he did. We asked him to explain a few things, and they did. And they became the best of friends. First time anybody ever used communication on this group. New and startling innovation all by itself, much less getting them to define things. So there is no level to which this type of group handling cannot be addressed. I don't know what kind of a lecture Dr. Richie Steves gave last night out in Bethesda, or wherever it was. But he talked to a women's club. And I don't know what he said to them. I don't know what he asked them. But this morning on the phone, a probation officer who has 19,000 juvenile delinquents under her thumb is trying to get in touch with Dr. Steve so that our counseling service could be employed officially. That's interesting, isn't it? Supposing you were out someplace and you say, well, I'm going to get any breakers. How's any money coming out of this? I mean, how am I ever going to live or something of the sort? Doesn't appear you don't assume enough control of the society to make it contribute to you. That's the only thing that happens. You don't let it contribute to you. If you're going to call in people and process them individually without anything else, if you're going to call in groups and talk to the groups, and that's all you're going to do. You've never gotten enough to contribute, and you won't be supported. You'll have a bad time. It's an interesting thing that the founding church itself has been very successful in starting new offices and so forth. That is because we are hounds today on the subject of smooth, precise administration. We're mean on the subject. And we are also mean on the subject of contribute. And if we train people, and if we process people, and if we bring people into groups, we ask that they pay their bills. Then this itself seems to be therapeutic. There's an organization which permits, that gives them service quite overtly, and they are permitted to give the organization both the benefit of their services and money. They give information service, they give money service. It works out. But nobody running a sloppy administration line will ever make it. The administration alone will defeat it. Actually, it was the inability to administer such an enormously large, mushrooming organization with no formed plan of administration which caused the collapse of federal organizations back in 1960. There were people there who were experts who had been brought in from large corporations in the field of administration. But we found out that large corporations don't know how to administer it. It requires a level of precision and assignment of time quite foreign to most companies and organizations to run time policy. You have to be much better than the society as a whole to make enough impression on them so that they know you're there. How do they know you're there? You start to change and stop them by administration. The administration is prompt. The class begins at 7:30. Not 7:31 or 7:29. It runs for an hour. It runs for an hour, maybe in a break. It runs for an hour and a question period. But it runs on an agreed upon basis, and it runs. Now that's all part and parcel of administration. A slip of paper for everybody that says he's there. Here's administration. Answering your mail. Answering your phone call. You don't think people would try to stay in business as a professional auditor, do you? And not answer their mail and not answer their phone calls. Nobody'd be foolish enough to do that. No, I'm afraid that everybody is that foolish. In London, an auditor was complaining to me that he was having difficulty with his practice. He was in an individual practice level. Having difficulty with his practice, and I said, well, how many phone calls do you get a day? Oh, he says, I'm out so much. Oh, I said, well, you have an answering service, don't you, or something? No. Well, I said, how long has it been since you made sure that all of your mail was up to date? He said, I haven't got time to fool with that. You haven't got time to fool with that, and he's just telling me you haven't now got to practice. It consists of communication lines between you and the public. Your communication of the lines of the public is, to a small degree, an individual, to a little better degree, a group you've assembled. And you keep them communicating to the public. And a much better degree, you're removing yourself from where you are, out to groups, out to various activities, circulating yourself, communicating. And then if you've communicated, why neglect the groups of your communication? You answer your mail. You make sure your telephone is answering. Those seem to be elementary steps. but they are very usually overlooked. If you have an ad to call you between 4 and 7, do you think the public is going to call you between 4 and 7? No. That's nonsense. They call you at 9, they call you at 12, they call you at 3, and they're very upset, and they don't call back if you're not there at 3, even though you said between 4 and 7. The public is an undisciplined man. They're not going to be disciplined by your ad. They hardly read the ad. They can't tell you any of the details in the ad. You're amazed how little they see. Great big sign stretched across the road with enormous black and white striped sawhorses saying, detour, points to the right. A little hole at the end of the sawhorses that a car can get through and around, and the pavement goes on for about a mile and then dead ends. I lived one time in exactly the end of a dead-ended pavement, and a detour sign, as is the custom with most public works, was there for almost a year and a half. And every day, five or six people would stop at the house and say, "What happened to the road?" The letters on that sign were 20 inches high. I measured them. How did they miss it? Well, don't think they're going to read a classified ad or your booklet. They even get your address wrong, and they get all sorts of other things wrong. You're only getting the upper class, the higher strata, who can remember your phone number long enough to put it on the dial. That's the public. You've got to answer up when you're called, and you've got to answer your communications when they receive by mail. And you've got to keep that right up to snuff. And someday the infernal ravening comes along and says to you, how is it that you return for the umpteenth of jump tumble all reflect a minus quotient when we have a millionaire over here that says he paid you $28,726? You haven't got any financial and banking records. They didn't take you away, they throw you in jail, and they do a crisis fact to your minister because the infernal ravening is a product of the devil. So when you get any money in, you write down in a receipt book, which costs 50 cents or a dollar or two, which has carbon copies. You give the person that gave you the money a white slip. And you put the yellow over in the file, and you keep the white, transparent, or whatever is left in the book. You keep that in the book. So when you pay a bill, you pay it by check. You don't pay it by cash. And if you never send these things in the books, you still have a complete set of books bearing in effect. You have all the money you received, because that came in and was represented in invoice books. And you have all the money you disbursed because that's represented in checkbooks and bank statements. And nobody's ever going to push you up against the wall, or even the frequent. You can put in and say, "Remember the $596 which I paid you." He didn't. You say, "Where is your receipt?" That is elementary business, isn't it? Keep it elementary. Don't build it up into a huge pyramid of horror. But you have to take these business-like steps. If a sign appears on an office door you have rented somewhere, that you are there between 9 and 12 every morning, please have somebody there between 9 and 12. And if you don't intend to be there, take the sign off the door and say, "Sometimes." In other words, a professional attitude is best represented by the elementary steps taken by a professional, regardless of what you're doing. And those steps are consistent, making it possible to receive communications, making it possible to get those communications answered and keeping them answered, taking care of the money communication line by invoicing all of the incoming money and paying all of your bills by check. And you just don't lose from there on. You just chop about 90% of the randomity out of your life right that minute. Gone. Now you can spend your time on building up the practice of running improvement. Your best bet these days to assemble a group, to assemble a practice, happens to be Scientology, the problems of work, and Scientology, the fundamentals of thought. And 100 copies of either one can be bought for very little money, about $35 a hundred. Getting these spread around requires legwork. Don't think there's anything in this universe that is completely easy to do. There's nothing that would be totally easy to do that would be worth doing. There's always some hard work alongside of any worthwhile project. There's always some heartbreak and there's always upset. That's the way this universe is built. Take it inside. People around here were placing Scientology problems and work and their own projects in drugstores. They bought a whole batch of them. They were placing in drugstores, a couple of people, two separate projects here. And for days and days and days and days and days, there wasn't one single one of them disappeared off any counter anyplace. And what a lot of work it was to make the druggists accept them because they didn't fit the racks. He had ideas of exactly how the book should look in order to be put on the rack, and exactly how it should look in order to be sold, and how it should have a naked woman on the cover. And he had big ideas about the whole thing. That he is dead wrong, and that he's not selling books. Just beside the point, he had an awful lot of interesting ideas. And I dare say the bookseller's ideas, the bookstore ideas, are interesting. But remember this, they don't sell books. The magazines would move off Safeway, grocery store racks and Rexall drugstore racks are so slight as to be negligible. If a book in this country only has to sell 5,000 or 6,000 copies to be a bestseller, it tells you that the thousands and thousands of bookstores in this country do not know how to merchandise. Now, usually, you can work at the reverse. You say, well, if they do it that way, that must be the way that it should be done. But this is not true in the field of the written word, in the field of publication, that is not true. I know, I was once the president of the American Fiction Guild. I conducted a survey of merchandising of magazines and books, and I found out that they were totally dedicated to the most unworkable methods. If you want a magazine or a book to sell, it's got to be a different size. They'll have to locate it someplace else then, and it won't be sold. The other thing is, it's got to be put there so painlessly and collected for so painlessly that nobody is disturbed. So a complicated administrative system in placing books in drugstores is definitely not indicated. And some of these drugstore owners and so forth don't want it because they say, well, look, it won't fit on the rack and it's the wrong color and so forth, and I couldn't sell that anyway, and I'll have to put it up here by the cash register. And you say, you really got an idea. We'll put it beside the cash register. No, go ahead, leave it there. These kids had a hard time getting books into drugstores and so forth, but they made it. And for days and days and days, not a single copy sold. Nothing happened at all. There was nothing moving at all. It was just one long, endless calm lag as far as they were concerned. And all the work was for nothing. And all of a sudden, they started to sell. By the time they'd worn out two pairs of shoes walking around to all of the drugstores they had listed up and written down in their little memo book, just about that time, it all of a sudden started to pay off. But remember, it had worn out two pairs of shoes. And these books are now selling all around town now, one way or another. The books are starting to sell. The last word I saw on this, starting to sell rather well. If you stamped into those books, those 100 books you had, your name and address, how you could be reached. For local information on this subject, call so-and-so, such-and-such a phone number, such-and-such an address. Stamp it into the books, put the books around.
You find out the books will all sell. Eventually, you collect most of the money that's owed to you, put them in our consignment. Say, now look, I've given you 15 books. I'm here. I'm going to come back, and we do. We come back, and there's 14 books. You tell a fellow you owe me $1. So you owe me 50 cents. We place it in there at about a 50% discount. They like it. All right, that existence of your name and telephone number in those books that they distribute around about the place gives you people who will then call you back. A book is better than personal contact in the United States. Because what people say is not believed, and what people read is believed is true. That which you read is true. Now, you could go and do a very unsuccessful book distribution program. No doubt about it. I think you'd have to do several things wrong in order to accomplish it. But you could do a successfully unsuccessful distribution program on the subject of books. In that, you could spend money, and too much money, on advertising, which would not pay off. You could choose the wrong district. You could say, well, sell these books as Park Avenue. We never sell anything down here on the West End. Park Avenue, you know, Park Avenue. And that area down around the Battery, where they have all those clothing secondhand stores, that's where they know books would sell down there. And your judgment could be wrong. They might sell on Park Avenue. They might sell on the West End. They might sell down on the Battery. And you just sort of sort it out and take the chance. In Ireland, constant argument with the young Scientologist over there on the subject of ad placement had to be utilized to overcome his prejudice about putting it in the labor paper. And the sole support of the American College Personnel Efficiency in Dublin for a very long time came exclusively from the longshoremen of Dublin. They were the only people who showed up and stuck. They didn't like coming. They walk in there. Listen. Hear the screen. Left, top, straight around. They were there every night. Nice and clean. Next crew that showed up, they kept on coming, and others kept on coming. The next crew that showed up at the behest of a brewmaster. He took all the people working around his brewery, and he figured they needed something. And he didn't know what, and maybe he had it, and he herded them in down there wholesale. And these people, the janitors and the rest of them, were absolutely top. They, after all, were people who could exert enough energy to work. We could do you wrong. In England, a lot of upper crust, screen stars, stage stars, has taken Scientology and they're doing wonderfully with it. If you read the English papers, it's quite customary that so-and-so, Hog Harden,